Thank you guys so much for coming out tonight. It's so great to be, for me, back in New York and seeing all of our supporters in person again. This is our first event we've had since December 2019, so it's really exciting that we're all able to get together here tonight. So thank you again for coming. My name is Erin Wolf. I'm a philanthropy associate here at GiveWell, and I'm excited to kind of share some updates about GiveWell from this year, as well as our updated giving recommendations. As you know, our goal is to direct funding to programs where it can do the most good per dollar spent. We publish our research online and our analysis transparently. When we first started GiveWell in 2007, which was 15 years ago, GiveWell cast a very wide net looking at all kinds of causes. Today, we focus on finding programs in low and middle income countries that save and improve lives, measured as increases in income. Most people here today probably know GiveWell for our work on our top charities. The first step in our research process is for finding top charities and other organizations to support is to assess the evidence about promising programs, whether that's through randomized controlled trials or other modeling and monitoring information that we have. We then look for experienced organizations that might be good partners and are successful at implementing the program. We model their work through our cost-effectiveness analysis and make any adjustments that might change the program positively or negatively. So we currently recommend 4 charities, which you can see up here. 2 are focused on malaria prevention. So we have Against Malaria Foundation and Malaria Consortium, which we'll actually talk a little bit more about later in the presentation. Next, we have Helen Keller International, which we recommend for their vitamin A supplementation work. Vitamin A is an essential nutrient that your body needs that supports the immune system. And supplementation in young children prevents stunting, anemia, blindness, and death. Then our 4th top charity is New Incentives. They run a program in Nigeria that gives caregivers small cash transfers to get their infants vaccinated. These routine vaccinations protect against tuberculosis, measles, and whooping cough. So based on our grant-making criteria, we're looking for programs that are cost-effective, evidence-backed, transparent, and able to use funding cost-effectively going forward, which we call our Room for More Funding. You may notice that our list is smaller than in past years. We actually updated our criteria this year so that we could have more differentiation between our top charities list and other grants that we make. So top charities, the new additional criteria on top of the ones I just mentioned, that they have to be a past grantee, have a direct impact, and have funding gaps at our current cost effectiveness bar, which is currently 10 times as cost effective as unconditional cash transfers. We also have high confidence in the impact of our top charities being realized. And so the final criteria is that there's a high likelihood of high impact, as opposed to a lower likelihood of very high impact. So GiveWell has grown a lot in the past 15 years, and as you can see here, the last decade. We raised almost $600 million last year, which many of this growth has come from supporters like you, so thank you so much for being a part of that. We hope this year we'll have a similar upward trajectory, and we will, and as well as the years to come. So many of these grants went to our top charities, but we also direct a significant amount of grant making to programs that are not on our top charities list. So there are many great opportunities that don't meet our strict criteria for top charities, but we believe that they are cost effective. So last year, of that total we just saw, we granted out $190 million to such programs, and we expect to grant out a similar amount this year. So on that note, I'm excited to announce that, well, not announced, this is a couple months ago, it was officially announced, but we have a new giving option for donors called the All Grants Fund. This is new, and previously grants like the ones that we made earlier were supported by Open Philanthropy, a large foundation that we work closely with. But now any GiveWell donor can support these additional programs. So donations to the All Grants Fund can be allocated to any grant that meets our cost effectiveness bar, including our top charities, but also other programs as well. This fund makes grants on a rolling basis and is a good fit for donors who are open to multiple pathways to impact, including ones that are higher risk. So is this like a new giving option this year? I want to spend some time on this and kind of discuss the types of grants that we could grant out from, as we don't have any specific examples as this is new. So there's four different categories of similar types of grants that we've made that would potentially be similar ones that we could grant out. So the first of those types of programs are programs that are potentially scalable, the kind of program that might eventually become a top charity. So an example of this is New Incentives, which is a current top charity. When you first discovered New Incentives, they were working on conditional cash transfers to encourage HIV-positive pregnant women to give birth in facilities to reduce the transmission from parent to child. Their team was really strong, and they tested out a few different programs, but couldn't find something that seemed effective and scalable. So we worked together with them, and we supported them to shift their focus to incentives for vaccines, which is our current program. We funded a randomized controlled trial of this program. The results came back, looked cost-effective, and they are now a top charity. So we're always looking for programs that might be that will be effective and scalable. So whether that's in areas where our current top charities work, so we also have supported kind of a similar vaccination program in Pakistan, and another vitamin A program that was not led by Helen Keller International. But also could be newer interventions, like we made a very large grant in water quality earlier this year. So the next kind of category is grants for cost-effective giving opportunities that we don't expect to be able to scale up or become a top charity. So these are more like one-off opportunities that have a high impact. So an example of this work is in the early days of the pandemic, we made some grants to support COVID response projects. One of those grants was to Development Media International on running mass media campaigns through the radio to promote hand washing, social distancing, and cough etiquette in 9 countries. So we also make grants to programs that advocate for improvements in public health regulation in low-income countries. It's potentially high leverage, and if we can support the governments of countries to make one-time changes that positively impact a whole population for years to come. So an example of this is we made an $8 million grant to an organization called Pure Earth last year. Lead exposure remains a significant barrier to health and development in low and middle income countries. Pure Earth is working to identify the most common sources of lead exposure in a set of high-risk countries, and then develop policies that the government can adopt to reduce exposure. This type of grant is exciting because it's it's received relatively little philanthropic support relative to the burden it imposes. It's a neglected area and offers potential for leveraged impact at a relatively low cost. And we can also use non-top charity grant-making funds to support research into programs to improve our future grant-making abilities. So earlier this year, we recommended a grant to an organization called Bridges to Prosperity. They build footbridges in rural communities to connect remote households to schools, health clinics, markets. We believe these grants are likely to increase income for families for years to come. So Bridges to Prosperity, they're currently implementing a large randomized controlled trial of their program, and our grant doubled the number of bridges that will be used in the trial, therefore enhancing the quality of the study. So given the direct impact of the bridges themselves and the information that we're going to gain from this new research study, we believe this is a really cost-effective use of funding. So for every grant that we have made, there are many more that we have not made and we chose not to make. We cast a very wide net for our research pipeline. We start by doing a shallow investigation into many programs and then investigate more in-depth the ones that look more promising. Right now, we have over 350 programs in our pipeline. We're doing more in-depth investigations into about 60 of them. And then we think around 20 of those will result in grants. So in terms of our forward priorities, I want to just briefly share a few promising programs that we're looking into. So first one here is participatory learning in action. Researchers believe that low uptake of essential newborn care practices, such as drying and wrapping babies after birth and skin-to-skin contact, and lack of timely care contribute significantly to high neonatal, postneonatal, and maternal mortality rates for many low-income countries. So this program consists of running facilitated meetings of groups of women of reproductive age, especially pregnant women, to develop localized strategies to increase and appropriately care for this update of these preventative measures. And this program looks cost-effective and could scale up well, and so we're looking and supporting organizations for potential funding. Next is that we launched a partnership with the Clinton Health Access Initiative, which is known as CHAI, an incubator with them. We're funding a team within their own organization that is going to scope and pilot potentially promising programs. So some of the interventions that we like to work with CHAI on are maternal and child health interventions, including safe birth kits and antenatal care programs, contact tracing for tuberculosis, and micronutrient supplementation for pregnant women. So I'd now like to introduce my colleague, Grace Holtquist. She's a senior program associate at GiveWell. She works on our grant making to our top charities focused on malaria.
Hi, everyone. Oh, how closely do I talk into this? Can you hear me? Cool. As Erin said, I'm Grace. Very nice to see all of you here. Also, as Erin said, we haven't had one of these for several years now. So for those of us who spend all day working from home looking at spreadsheets, it's nice to see that there are people who are actually interested in what we're doing. So I'm here to talk a little bit about malaria. There are a few people on the research team who work on programs focused on malaria. I work specifically with our top charities that implement malaria control interventions, so I will be best placed to answer any questions you have about those organizations. So introduction to malaria. Why is it a problem? Malaria is a very large global health issue. It's a life-threatening disease caused by parasites that are transmitted to people through the bites of mosquitoes. But it's preventable and curable. But left untreated, it can progress rapidly to causing severe illness and death in some cases, especially among young children. The estimated number of malaria deaths in 2020 was around 600,000, which actually represented an increase from the year before. So there's this concerning trend happening right now in malaria where mortality was falling year on year, and then starting around like 2015, that started to plateau, and then it's actually ticked up a little bit in recent years. The WHO thinks that is because of disruptions to basic health services caused by the COVID pandemic, but it sort of remains to be seen whether that trend will continue or go back to what we were seeing prior to the start of the pandemic. And it's a particularly big problem in Africa. In 2020, the WHO African region was home to about 95% of malaria cases, and children under 5 accounted for 80% of all malaria deaths globally. And it's actually just a few countries in Africa that carry that huge burden. A very high proportion of those deaths are just in a few countries: the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Nigeria, Tanzania, and Mozambique. So I will now talk a little bit about the programs that my team supports to try to tackle this problem. So one is insecticide-treated bed nets. These are large nets that are delivered to households and that people hang above their beds to sleep under at night. They are designed both to provide a physical barrier that blocks mosquitoes from getting in and biting people, and they're also treated with an insecticide that kills mosquitoes. And typically, countries implement these big nationwide campaigns where once every 3 years, people all around the country go out, community health workers, volunteers, go out to rural communities and literally travel household to household, delivering the number of nets that would be needed to cover all of the people who live in each household so that they can be protected from contracting malaria at night while they sleep. AMF, the Against Malaria Foundation, is an organization that purchases these nets in bulk and then reaches agreements with the government agencies in developing countries that are focused on tackling malaria to donate those nets to those countries, which are then tasked with that big delivery project that I was just describing. AMF's role is to bring expertise in terms of figuring out what type of nets to purchase that might be most effective in any given context, and then negotiating with manufacturers to try to get the lowest price that they can for buying those nets. Through 2021, AMF had supported or had donated nets to large-scale distributions in 8 countries across Africa and Southeast Asia and had purchased around 85 million nets. The other big focus for my team is a program called Seasonal Malaria Chemoprevention, or SMC. And what this is an intervention that is delivered to areas where the majority of the malaria burden that happens every year happens in just a short window of time. It's typically parts of the continent that have a rainy season versus a dry season. So during the rainy season, mosquitoes breed, and that's when there's a big peak in malaria cases. There is a program called SMC that works to prevent high transmission of malaria during that season. And the way that it works is, again, it's one of these big mass campaigns where you have community health workers, paid distributors, volunteers, traveling household to household, finding households that have young children, and then administering anti-malarial drugs to those kids, and then giving the caregivers of those kids additional drugs that they can give them over the next few days. And the effect of taking these drugs is that kids are protected from contracting malaria for a period of about 28 days. And so the way that the program works is that big effort happens about once a month during the part of the year when malaria is seasonal. So the idea being that at the beginning of every month, kids will get this big dose of anti-malarial drug in their system that should prevent them from contracting the disease. So our primary grantee for SMC is an organization called Malaria Consortium, which currently supports, with GiveWell-directed funding, large-scale SMC programs in Burkina Faso, Chad, Nigeria, and Togo. And also with GiveWell-directed funding, they're piloting the program in a few new countries that are outside the region of the continent where SMC has typically been delivered in the past, but where it's starting to look like it might be a promising intervention to expand. And here in these photos, you can see what the drugs look like, and there is a little girl receiving the drugs. So why do we focus on malaria? One of the reasons is what I said at the top about malaria just being a major cause of illness and death globally. So if disease burden is really high, we try to find programs that we believe there is the potential to direct a lot of funding to over the medium or long term. And that is certainly the case with malaria. Fortunately, though, there are these evidence-backed direct delivery programs, NETS and SMC, that we know can actually have an impact in helping to solve that problem, which is not always the case. But fortunately for malaria, there are actual tools that we know work. The other thing that's wonderful about both of these interventions is that on a per-person basis, they're extremely inexpensive. They, in the models that we build, end up looking cost-effective in a wide variety of contexts. And then the fourth reason is that despite, you know, all of the focus that the global health community puts on malaria, funding is far below what is actually needed to get to a situation in which we are even controlling malaria. We're nowhere close to eliminating it, which is the ultimate goal. And so we just continue to see very large what we call funding gaps, which what we mean by that is like an opportunity to deliver services that we don't think is going to be funded if we don't do something about it. So going back to what my role is at GiveWell, I work on the team that works with our top charities, and one of our jobs is every quarter to decide what to do with the Top Charities Fund, which used to be called the Maximum Impact Fund. And our goal with that fund is to direct it to whatever we think the highest priority funding gap is at that time. And that's based on our estimate of that funding gap's cost effectiveness and then also our understanding of how urgently the funding is needed. So to make these decisions, We sort of try to have a map of all of the funding gaps that exist at any given time. We do that by communicating with grantees, with government malaria programs, and other stakeholders to stay up to date on what the global needs are, on what gaps exist or are emerging. In response to learning about a funding gap, we will try to learn as much as we can about it so that we can update our existing cost effectiveness model for the intervention with details specific to this opportunity. And then we just end up having a lot of conversations with people to try to understand what the context is here, why is this not being funded, what would happen if we didn't make this grant, so that we're able to build all of that information into our ultimate estimate of the cost effectiveness of this opportunity. So our most recent allocation from the Top Charities Fund was around $8.5 million to Malaria Consortium's SMC program in Nigeria. We chose to do this allocation because we believe the SMC in Nigeria is one of the most cost-effective programs that we're aware of, at around 12 times as cost-effective as unconditional cash transfers. We've also supported this program for many years, and so we've seen repeated evidence that Malaria Consortium is able to reach a lot of kids with SMC at a low cost. There continues to be a large funding need based off of a report that Malaria Consortium submitted to us a few months back. It looks like they're going to need around $65 million to continue to provide the current level of support they're providing to the Nigerian government for an additional year. So they're funded right now through 2024, and so this funding is going to support their, it's going to extend that funding runway through 2025. And they need a lot more money to be able to do that at full scale. And then, as I said, we think it's an important criterion for us is that we think it's very unlikely that if we did not make this grant, this funding would come from some other source. And the reason that I think that is because even though malaria is a massive problem in Nigeria, which accounts for around 30% of the world's malaria deaths, there isn't nearly enough funding coming from the other major malaria funders. And a large part of the reason for that is that many major donors have caps on how much they can give to any given country, which means that large countries like Nigeria, which is a very populous country, end up receiving a lot less funding per capita. And so we end up factoring that information into our cost effectiveness model, which, as I said, attempt to capture the likelihood that if we didn't fund this, somebody else would. And in this case, factoring that in ends up making this already very cost effective program look like an even better opportunity. So our estimate is that the impact of this grant will be to enable Malaria Consortium to deliver a year's worth of SMC to 1 million children, which we expect to save around 1,700 lives, which is a little bit overwhelming to think about. And every time we do these calculations at the end of making a grant, kind of brings a lump to my throat. But it's very exciting and is ultimately why we do this work. And then, yeah, something that we get a lot of questions about because it's been receiving a lot of news coverage is the announcement that there is a newly WHO-approved malaria vaccine. This is really exciting. It's a huge development for the field, which has been working on a vaccine for many decades. We are continuing to follow the news on it to see if there are grants we can make to support the rollout of this vaccine. We have made one such grant earlier this year to an organization called PATH to speed up the deployment of the RTSS malaria vaccine to some areas in Kenya, Malawi, and Ghana that we think without this grant would have ended up, the kids who live in those areas would have ended up receiving the vaccine about a year later than they will because of this grant. And because this vaccine is effective at preventing malaria, even just speeding up its deployment by a year looks really cost effective to us. And yeah, as I said, we're just continuing to follow the news on this. We don't expect it to dramatically change our giving to other malaria interventions in the short term because right now there are a lot of supply constraints, and so we think at least in the next few years, kids are really going to need to be covered by bed nets and be reached by SMC. But we're hopeful that it will grow to have a larger impact, and there also is emerging evidence that combining the malaria vaccine with other interventions that we already support, like SMC, can actually have this synergistic effect where you're getting way more protection with both of them than you would expect with either of them being delivered on its own. So we might even look into like funding some more research on that and how co-delivered interventions can have even more impact. So yes, very exciting. So more to come on this. And with that, I will pass it back to Erin.
Thank you. All right, just to wrap up, I want to discuss our end of year giving recommendations. So this year, we expect that we won't raise enough funding for all the cost-effective opportunities that we've identified. Our research team has done a tremendous job of finding programs within our top, like giving opportunities within our top charities and elsewhere that are highly cost-effective. And we equate that to be around $900 million of opportunities that we would love to fund. However, our best guess of funds that we expect to raise this year at GiveWell is coming in around $600 million. That's, of course, an estimate. We're not sure how the end of the year will shake out, but it seems extremely likely that we will not be able to fund all the cost-effective opportunities that we've identified and will be leaving impact on the table. And our best guess, if we were able to fill that funding gap, it would save the lives of 30,000 children if we had the money. So if you would like to support or continue your support this year, just want to kind of go over the giving options, all of which are very impactful, just kind of depend on your preferences. So the first one is unrestricted giving. This is best if you're very aligned with our work, and we allocate this gifts first to support our operating costs, which funds our research team, our staff, all the work that we do. And then what we don't need, we fund out to charities. And so in short, we hold around 2 years of runway for operations and then grant out anything else to the highest next priority. Then the next options are all opportunities that GiveWell does not take any cut from. The money goes straight to our recommendations. So the All Grants Fund is the one I talked about earlier. This is a more flexible giving option that supports the highest priority funding needs we see, whether they're top charities or something else. And so that is a cool, exciting option that will have a broader base of opportunities. The Top Charities Fund, which Grace went over, that is good if you specifically are looking for the organizations that we are the most confident in, which are our top charities. And then finally, you can also specifically donate to one of the four top charities we have, either through our website or through their websites, if you are really into that specific program. And we know that they will all be able to use donations cost effectively. So those are all the options, so thank you. We're now going to do a Q&A, and so we'll open up for questions. It's going to be about the presentation or just anything else maybe you're thinking about GiveWell. My colleague Audrey Cooper, she's a philanthropy advisor, will be joining us as well. So yeah, thank you so much for being here again, and we'd love to hear what kind of questions you have for us.
Thanks for the presentation, it's super insightful. So when it comes to the Top Charities Fund, you mentioned that the Malaria Consortium's SMC program had runway until 2024. So I was wondering, what was the motivation behind allocating those funds now as opposed to waiting a year later as participants?
Can you repeat the question?
Yes, so the question was, why fund Malaria Consortium all the way into 2025 if they already have runway through 2024? We sort of just as a grant-making policy, try to be, for the programs where we are supporting at a large scale and sort of renewing year on year, usually at around the same scale, we try to stick to a policy of giving grantees a three-year funding runway. And the reason for that is just, twofold. One, we've heard a lot of feedback from them that it makes their planning easier, it makes having strong relationships with their government partners easier, And the other is like maybe a little bit softer, but like we want it to be an indication to them that we're really excited about these programs and we want them to sort of see GiveWell as a trusted partner and be able to come to us with new ideas and things they're worried about. And so we don't want them to sort of always be like operating in a nervous way and worried that they're going to be facing a funding cliff because something dramatic is going to change. So, yeah.
Hello. You mentioned that malaria deaths were declining over time until like 2015, and they've been on the uptick since 2020, which the WHO attributes to the pandemic. To me, that seems like the obvious explanation. Is there like another theory that could explain it?
Yeah, if I was like casting doubt on that explanation, I didn't mean to. I think that is like probably a large part of the explanation. It is also the case, though, that there are like other things that could be contributing to it. So, for example, for bed nets are one of the biggest used malaria control interventions, and a growing problem is mosquitoes that are resistant to the insecticides used in bed nets. In SMC, it's less of a problem, but there is concern that in the next few years we'll start seeing resistance to the actual malaria parasites to the medicine. So there are like issues like that. And then another concern is that things are getting more expensive. Commodities are getting more expensive. It's getting more expensive to procure commodities and ship them into countries. And so money is not going as far as it was a few years ago. But the amount of money going into malaria hasn't really kept pace with that increase in costs. So I think it's a combination of probably COVID disruptions, things aren't working as well because of reasons like drug resistance, and we're not getting as much for our dollar as we used to, and so like coverage of interventions is perhaps declining in some places.
By commodities, you mean part of the distribution of the thing?
Yeah, sorry, like the cost of nets is going up and the cost of SMC drugs is going up.
I can maybe speak up. Is it ever the case that you conclude that an intervention causes the go-forward funding gap to worsen? Like, say, if a sovereign country sees that there's money coming in from an institution like GiveWell, they might channel resources that were going there to just something that is, you know, not good or less effective.
Should I just project? That's a really good question, and something that keeps us up at night. I think we think that our funding is likely having that effect to some extent. I think at least for the interventions that we have funded for a long time and that we are associated with, we're pretty concerned that, understandably, governments are responding to that by saying, well, we know GiveWell is going to cover bed nets. They did it last time around, and so why wouldn't we divert this funding that we have available into this other service? We try to account for that in our cost effectiveness models, and so I actually spend like a lot of my job is getting on the phone with people to ask them questions to try to get at whether this is happening or like why they're making the decisions that they are with the money that they have from other sources, and then like reviewing public information about how other malaria funding flows are being used. And then there is a parameter input into each cost effectiveness estimate that we generate that is like obviously a pretty subjective guess about like what do I think for every dollar I can put into this grant, how much of it do I think would have been replaced by another source if we didn't exist. And those adjustments tend to be pretty high for things like malaria that where we're really worried that this could be happening. That being said, I don't want to overstate it, and we never make a grant where we like literally think there's a 100% chance that somebody else would do this if we didn't. And in all of the conversations that I have with people trying to get at whether this is happening, you know, the story that we increasingly hear is the one that I was just talking about, which is like there is really not enough money and budgets are tight and governments are making difficult decisions, and sometimes they do just have different priorities than we do, and so it could really be the case that when money is tight, they choose to do something differently than we would, and that's where we have the opportunity to step in and help out with our priorities.
Two quick questions, hopefully. The first is, can you elaborate a little bit on like the donor sort of distribution? Is it sort of like 10 rich people give like 90% of the money, or is it like a bunch of small donors that make up the bulk of like the donation? And then the second question is, I know a little bit about the methodology, obviously, from what you guys read on your blogs, but as folks who work, you know, internally, what's something that you think gives you sort of pause on the methodology, if anything? Like, I'm sure there's something that you think is like where you have the least amount of conviction on the methodology. That would just help us understand sort of where the strengths and weaknesses are a little bit. Thank you.
Hey, cool. Okay, so on the question about donor size, so all of this is actually available on our website if you would like to go and look. There's a full breakdown of numbers, but just to give you, it's called under something called the metrics report. If you want to look it up, there's like a specific breakdown by giving threshold. But the top line summary is about half of our funding comes from one foundation called Open Philanthropy. We work very closely with them. They actually started as something called GiveWell Labs, where it was kind of focused on more like speculative, newer work at GiveWell. And then we actually kind of split off into two organizations so that they could kind of specialize on that and we could continue to do our work. But as that developed, they are now also one of our largest funders. So they gave about $300 million of the $600 million that we raised last year. Beyond that, we have about 50,000 individual donors, and there's a few hundred people, maybe a couple thousand, who are giving high five figures, six figures, and making up a big chunk of the remaining money raised, and then quite a large base of tens of thousands of people who are giving less than that. So yeah, the distribution is slightly in that direction, but yeah, there's a big base of folks who are contributing at all levels.
Your question about what gives me the most pause. We've been talking a little bit about what we refer to as our funding bar, which right now is 10 times as cost effective as cash transfers. And we use that bar as a tool to try to match up all of the opportunities we think we're gonna be able to direct funds to in a year against how much money we think we're gonna be able to direct to those, and sort of we want to stop at the level where we're funding everything above the bar and not going below it, so that that money is used in the most cost-effective way possible. So it's a really helpful tool for making decisions for that reason. But sometimes the estimate that gets spat out at the end is 9.8 and then something else is 10.2, and there's enough uncertainty that we have about sort of each of the inputs that are going into those final estimates, that it can be hard to be confident that there's a real difference there, such that we should be making a decision about potentially tens of millions of dollars. The way that we try to mitigate this is that while we're usually making decisions based off of cost effectiveness numbers alone, the closer something is to our bar, whether it's right above it or right below it, we're really trying to consider like other qualitative reasons we might have to make this grant. So one would be like, if we make this grant, is there something we're gonna learn from it that's gonna like give us more confidence next time we have to make a decision here about what the cost effectiveness is? Or if we make this grant, do we think there's a chance that one of the sort of big major multilateral funders that exist in the world is going to take over this program, and so us making this grant is actually like bridging the gap and then increasing the cost effectiveness of the portfolio of that multilateral funder in the future. While we are usually making decisions using that bar, I feel a little iffy when we're making decisions really close to it, and so we try to find ways to have confidence in the final decision by considering other factors.
Well, it's really great to hear that a malaria vaccine is coming out. I was wondering if you'd give us some sense of the dynamics about why it's taken so long, given that this is a disease that's existed for a long time, and if the constraints have been, you know, phase one, phase two, phase three tests, or whatever they've been, and how much of a game changer you think this is likely to be over the next couple of years as it relates to that intervention.
Grace didn't do the malaria vaccine grant, so I'm going to talk about it. But basically, yeah, I don't know all the details of the research stages, but yes, there have been a number of trials. The WHO requires like quite a lot of testing in order to like actually officially approve something. So I don't even think we have all of the results from like RTSS, and there's another one called R21 that is coming out soon. I think we're waiting on another phase of results from there. But the top line now is that the vaccine's estimated to be something like 30 or 40% effective at preventing cases of malaria. So that's substantive, that's like a very big benefit, but it's certainly not like a silver bullet that is going to replace everything else that we're doing against malaria. When you look at like the state of the number of cases in the world, it's something that's gonna be probably ended up layering on top of other interventions. So it's a great tool, it's gonna be maybe more effective in some contexts than others, or places where the other interventions aren't accessible, that kind of thing. I think the WHO is actually recommending that in some cases it be applied in places that already have NETs being delivered or SMC being delivered. So I think that's more of how it's going to play out. Yeah.
Out of curiosity, what does the trajectory look like for GiveWell itself? Are you folks seeking to expand your team? Or I know there's a lot of layoffs happening now in anticipation of a recession. Is it the opposite? What are the next few years look like?
That's a great question. So we're very excited to grow as much as we can, because that's going to allow us to raise more money, deploy it to more effective charities, and help save and improve more lives. We're just like very focused on that. We're in a pretty strong position organizationally. We raised $600 million last year, and our operational budget is something like 10 to 15 million. So we're doing fine as far as like organizational strength goes. And we're actually very excited to grow our team, because in order to find more charities that can cost effectively use money and raise more money to fill those funding gaps, we need people to do that and help us to unlock those opportunities. So we're actually hiring for a lot of roles. If anyone's interested in applying, please go to our website. I think our trajectory is to grow as much as possible, because that's going to help us make more impact. And as you can see, we've grown pretty dramatically over the past few years. So we're hopeful that that can continue. Yeah.
How does OpenPhil set their allocation such that they're leaving the funding gap? Like they definitely have more than 300 million.
So they do. I don't know all the details of OpenPhil's base planning process, but at a very high level, pull Josh in a second, but at a very high level, OpenPhil has multiple focus areas, and they also have an intention to spend down their funds over their funder, Karen and Dustin's lifetimes. And so they're trying to maximize impact over a relatively long, or about like a medium-sized time horizon, right? Somebody's lifetime. And so as a result, you can imagine there's a lot of inputs into that, but you might not want to spend all of your money up front, because maybe there will be better opportunities later, or maybe you'll learn more, you'll become a better grant maker, you can have a better impact like as over time. And so they have kind of their own model for that spending rate, and then their own model for how they prioritize different areas. So they also do grant making towards animal welfare, they also do grant making towards more like what we would call like long-termism focused areas. So things like protecting the very far future against pandemics, or AI safety situations or stuff like that. So Open Philanthropy makes those decisions kind of using their own modeling and then communicates it to us. So that's just it. So they don't just fund us. Yeah.
I was wondering, I've been talking with some of my friends who are maybe not as sold on effective altruism as I am, and recently they brought up Sam Bankman-Fried and his association with EA, and it doesn't really change the equation for me, but it sounds like for them it's like another reason to be skeptical. So I'm wondering, like, I don't know how closely he was associated with GiveWell specifically, like maybe he was more involved with like the long-termism type stuff. So yeah, I'm curious, how closely was he associated with GiveWell? And two, like, are you thinking about how it might make people less excited about giving to GiveWell, potentially?
So for context, for anyone who hasn't been following the news, Sam Bankman-Fried ran a crypto exchange called FTX. There seems to have been fraud and bankruptcy, and he had pledged to give away all of his income to effective altruist kind of causes. And so there's been like a lot of coverage of that situation, and it's just like, yeah, really terrible news, obviously. And I'm as interested as you are in like seeing how it all develops and plays out. But as far as GiveWell goes, I think it has like a pretty limited impact on us directly. I mean, very literally, like Sam Bankman-Fried and FTX was focused on other causes primarily. So GiveWell's received one donation from the FTX Foundation of $1.5 million earlier this year. It was to our top charities fund, and so 3 months later, we granted it out to those organizations. And you know, out of a scale of raising $600 million last year, that's like a quarter of 1% of the funds that we raised. So very directly, like pretty limited impact. But as far as like, you know, the effective altruism movement in general, I think we could all speculate on what might or might not happen. But we feel like as GiveWell, we're extremely focused on our mission. We still think it's very compelling to be able to save and improve lives and raise money towards that end. And so, you know, hopefully there won't, other people will continue to feel the same way as we do.
Hi, I don't know much about malaria or really much about this, but I just had a question. So, you mentioned next treatment, possibly a vaccine coming, and I was thinking, so say in Nigeria, that was the worst, if you were to have a heat map of cases and saw it was like really red in one area where it's particularly bad and maybe a little bit blue, cooler somewhere else. And there were people there who had, in that red area who would be willing to relocate because they want to obviously, they might want to live somewhere safer. Obviously relocation is a very personal thing, but people who are willing to do that, is assisting with relocation something that GiveWell is concerned with or considers?
I think the short answer is we haven't done anything with relocation specifically, but there are a lot of like interesting technologies that like look at kind of like what you're describing as far as like a heat map exactly, but like how can we target interventions better? How can we use the data we have to figure out which interventions are best suited to different areas? So can't get into too many details because it's a program we're considering but haven't funded yet, but there are actually like a couple specific technologies that we have been interested in where we could maybe learn a lot more about like, yeah, certain things in the geography that might cause, you know, mosquitoes to breed more frequently and then like specifically deploy treatments to those areas. So there's, yeah, a lot of potential for more creative solutions for sure.
One more?
Yeah.
Hi there. I know a lot of GiveWell's funding seems to come from EA people. I was wondering what portion of you guys' funding comes from religious affiliated organizations and whether or not you have, in talks with people about like redirecting tithe funding, for instance, or helping people split in tithe funding or zakat funding better.
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know how much like literal data we have on that, but I think like our general impressions are there's like a very core number of like effective altruists who support GiveWell, but especially in recent years, there's been a growing base of people from all backgrounds who have ended up kind of finding our work and resonating with it. As far as religious groups go, very anecdotally, there are a number of like effective altruism for Christians or for, you know, other religious groups that have kind of reached out to us about like We've given talks at, you know, their groups or at different like conferences and things that are specifically targeted to people from a specific background, and those have seemed to be really fruitful conversations. Yeah, I think people who are within those communities often kind of are best at spreading the message, and so we really like partnering with those kind of already organized groups in order to do that. But yeah, it's definitely been fruitful. Okay, one more.
So this is kind of expands upon the last question a little bit. So it seems like the biggest constraint for GiveWell at this time is like the funding gaps. So I was curious as to like what sort of strategies or groups of people that you might be trying to reach, groups of people that you haven't accessed before, sort of to access whether channels in which that you might be able to close those funding gaps.
Yeah, so that's definitely correct. But like this year, that's the barrier to impact. But I mean, on an ongoing basis, also, I would say like we also need to grow like our research, the number of charities that we partner with, and all that. So just like in the long term, I think we want both of those things to grow. But this year, most specifically, I mean, we definitely like increased our communications and just like trying to reach new audiences. So some of that is to our existing donors. You know, we always try to be very respectful of people's choices, but share as much information as we can about our grants and the needs so that people can then make their decisions. And then we've also done quite a bit of, well, maybe not quite a bit, but we've done more advertising than GiveWell has ever done as far as like trying to reach new audiences. So specifically, we're doing advertising on podcasts, YouTube, and then a couple of Substack newsletters for very specific niche audiences. As you can imagine, like sometimes people with tech and finance and like quantitative backgrounds really resonate with our message. So we have found that that could be a fruitful place to find new donors who may not have heard of us before. So yeah, those newsletters and podcasts and YouTube channels have been a good way to meet new people. So we've definitely invested in that more this year. And then also just like referrals from our existing donor community, especially for, you know, large donors who have foundations and have kind of networks of people who are thinking about their philanthropic strategy. We have kind of built out staff capacity to be able to work individually, like one-on-one with them in a kind of like consulting advisory role. And so that's also been really, really important. Yeah.
All right, thank you for those really great questions. We're gonna close this portion of the event right now. We have the space for a while afterwards, so we definitely encourage you to come stay, mingle. I'm also gonna point out, or have everyone who works at GiveWell raise their hand right now. So if you have any additional questions and would like to speak to a GiveWell staff member, we're happy to talk to you. We'd love to hear about everything. So come find us, and please enjoy the rest of the night. Thank you again for coming. We really appreciate it.